For years, Gone South has been a podcast about crime in the American South. But for our new season, we're widening the lens. Through deeply reported, narrative-driven stories, we're digging into the myths, scandals, and power structures that still shape the South, and in a lot of ways, the country itself. Follow and listen to Gone South Season 5, an Odyssey podcast, available now on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your shows.
Larry Richard Unfiltered with Jim Crenn, Sheila Hyland, episode 49. Let's call this the beginning of a holiday episode because Thanksgiving, next thing you know, you're rolling into Christmas, the new year. You got Hanukkah, Kwanzaa, Festivus.
With the rest of us.
Can we get Marty on next podcast? I hope. We'll see how the schedule is. 50th. We'll see.
Just you know, throwing it out there. That's the 50th episode.
Just throwing it out there. If he'll do it next week, we don't know.
I really am going to push for that.
See what he says.
I really want to.
Do you have to push? Doesn't he just want to come on here? Wasn't that his idea?
Yeah. It was. I sort of pushed him there.
Marty.
I nudged him.
And I told this to Marty. I said, people ask me all the time, what's it like to work with Marty? He's so over the top. I said, it's like being verbally tased every 10 minutes.
That's kind of nice.
Eventually.
I enjoy that, actually. It'd be exciting.
It is important.
I love the way he goes, Lair.
And you've listened.
I love Marty. Jim. And you. I think you guys work well together. I like the energy, man.
It is a different vibe for me.
It's a good
because
yin to your yang.
I spent so many years with Shumway, 15 and a half years in radio, plus 4 in TV.
Yeah.
And then with Kevin. And then before that, I was with Shelley Duffy on the show, too.
It's a different energy, and I like it.
Okay.
You need a little jolt. It's kind of fun.
All right.
Could put you on your horse a little bit. He's fun. He's funny, informative. You are brilliant. I think you're a great storyteller. I think you're laid back, and the mixture of having that energy and the laid back is a good yin to your yang, is what I think.
Well, thank you. And at this stage of your career, you want to be who you are.
We'll try it all.
And to Marty's point, he's who he is, so hopefully you can find that balance.
Okay, but I just have to ask, how do you get a word in edgewise with him?
It just depends. Later in the show, he's starting to go on, you know, texting people. Mm-hmm. So he's always working, and he has so many insiders in the business, and he truly does. Like, the people that know what is going on in this town.
Right.
Now, the one thing, I know it's hard for people because the morning is a balance. You have to have some levity.
Right.
Jim, you made your career on levity, which I loved and people loved. But the gun violence for juveniles in this town, and nowhere to put them. So they know that. So we've seen gun violence. And Jim, you're a Southside resident.
Right.
You know business owners who have suddenly changed their minds. So I said to Marty, if our mantra is breaking news and making a difference, I'd like to find a way to really start stemming the tide of that gun violence in our city, because it's affecting everybody.
Right. Right. And some of it's, you know, groups coming in from out of town, you know, maybe not Pittsburgh, maybe visiting.
Do you feel as safe as you ever did in Southside?
I do. I'll tell you why, guys. I grew up in a city my whole life. I grew up in an alley on 12th Street behind Heinz History Center. And it wasn't a real kind strip district back then. It was a little rough around the edges. When you live in the city, there's going to be some edge, man. So there's a difference between living in a city and there's a difference between living in the suburbs. There's a difference, you know, any city. It could be New York, it could be Pittsburgh, it could be Philly, I don't care if it's Toledo. It's downtown, it's downtown. There's a certain different energy. You're going to have visitors, transient, things like that. It's going to be a little more congested. You're going to have a little more activity, both good and bad. So I am accustomed to the possibility of having the possibility of something happen. So I keep my edge, keep my guard. I'm not shocked when it does happen. So I'm thinking, all right, that's part of living in the city. There's just more people here. It's more congested. Something could go wrong. There's humanity. There's good and evil in the world. That's the way it is. So in the city, no, I walk my, you know, I have Larry, the dog. I walk him all through the neighborhood at night. I'll go at 9:30, 10. Now, here's the thing with the city, guys. When I moved to Northside, the schoolhouse apartments, great apartments. I love them. When I first got, I was on the road for about 6 years doing stand-up, and I ended up getting a gig on DV, and I'm it's like I'm 26 years old, and all of a sudden I'm on billboards and stuff. I'm like, what the hell is this all about? So I get this place in school. Now, I grew up in the city, so I know how to live on Northside. In other words, it's right across from Allegheny Hospital. So we'd have Tim, the guy who was a maintenance guy, he'd be changing our locks out front all the time for the moment. What happened? He goes, doctor got, mugged the other day. And said, he walked into West Park at 1 in the morning because they have odd shifts, doctors, emergency room. He's just taking a stroll in West Park at 1 in the morning. Well, guess what? If you take a stroll in certain areas, you could get mugged. You're raising your average. So you have to kind of be aware. I knew not to take a stroll. So on the south side, I know where not to go at certain times and where to go. Now, could something happen to me? Yeah, but it could happen to me anyway. Get hit by a bus. Could happen in a suburb. I could get attacked by a coyote. But I'm just saying, you got to know where to go. So I have certain streets. I know where to go. I know certain areas. I could walk. I feel more comfortable. There are less bars. There are less action. I know where the action is. So the idea is, be aware of your surroundings, whether you're in the suburbs or the city. I get it, because news is going to sell fear, and it's going to make the news is going to make it bigger than it has to.
But you
should
can't
be,
deny
you
some
know
of
that
these events have that, gone
no,
on.
No, it's saying they're happening.
A lot more violence.
But you can't deny the news.
You can't
deny the news makes it more heightened because fear sells.
Yeah, but I did live on the South Side for 9 months. It was my first time living in or near the city.
Yeah,
and I knew that after that 9 months, it was time for me to get out. But as a female, we experience fear probably a lot more than you do.
Well, it keeps you alive.
Every time I'm in a parking garage,
sure.
Anytime I'm by myself, I am hyper aware of my surroundings.
Right.
And I don't know that generally men feel that the way we women do.
You have to survive in a city. You got to keep your guard up. That's what I'm saying. That's the difference.
Yeah. There's if you are used to that, then Sheila, to your point, you're aware of your surroundings. Now, it can be uncomfortable. I know when I worked downtown at KDK-TV in the Gateway Center area, there were some times because of construction when they were putting in the subway, our one block subway.
Yes.
So we had to park, and then I have to walk at early morning hours, before the dawn, way before the dawn. And suddenly it was a different vibe. And that's when the city would be considered a lot safer then than a lot of people feel it is now.
Sure, I agree. I lived in a real nice suburb for 20-some years. Keep your doors open. So you thought, till police officer said, Jimmy, there's a couple that are checking doors and houses and robbing them. Really? A couple? Yeah, an old couple walking there. My point is, crime could be anywhere. And that's not a violent crime, but I'm just saying crime could be anywhere. I just think that our city in general, is in general, compared to other cities, I think we're a fairly safe city. I feel comfortable in most of the neighborhoods. If I want to have a place where I just don't want to lock the doors, I'll go to Swickling, live in Centennial Street. But I get it. I'm going to have my doors locked on the south side. I like the edge. That's the way I like to live. It's a preference, not for everyone.
Remember during COVID?
Yeah.
We didn't hear about any violence during COVID.
So there had to be violence.
It was unbelievable.
There probably was.
Well, I don't know.
Because COVID wasn't COVID selling news?
Well,
wasn't violence push us? Didn't you have enough fear?
This is local news. You'd have heard about it.
There wasn't any. There couldn't have been as much crime because there weren't anybody walking
out.
Around.
Yeah.
There wasn't anybody.
Yeah.
No. That's
it's like we're making up for lost time now.
I still think there could have been violence. There could have been violence
Where
in homes maybe we saw. I think there could have been violence going on. I think when you know all about the news. You've been on the news. I worked in the news during certain sporadic parts of my life where I'd be on doing some projects. And I remember working in different stations. And I got to tell you, I was in those meetings, fear sells. That's what we're getting from the national news, local news. And we have the best local news. I think we have great anchors, great reporters. But in general, it's a competitive game. You know that more than anyone, Sheila. You tell me, did you do a bunch of happy stories or feel good stories? Or was it mostly fear kind of sells? COVID brought ratings to every cable station, the highest ratings ever. One, we were stuck in the house, yes. But also, and it was real, okay? There's people dying. But there was also maybe a little push to, fear. Fear sells, in other words.
Yeah.
So with the violence, I think it sells. I think you're going to get bit more dramatic. I think it's horrible, obviously. We don't want violence, but I don't think we could write. We just can't wipe out evil in the world. And I don't. The only thing we do is maybe try to address a problem if we see a continual violence in the city. Okay, raise taxes, whatever we have to do, which we don't like to do, and help the police more. Help the police more, you know? Give them a chance. Really, it's kind of tough to be a police officer. But help them more. And maybe pay them more. Maybe, you know, want violence? That's what you do. But we don't do that, do we? We just kind of like talk about the violence and like, what are we going to do? But there's remedies to it if we want. But because there's a certain level where, you know, well, I'm pretty good. Fortunately, haven't been mugged on the South Side or anything. Maybe I have a different tune if I was, you know. Someone out there's listening to Jim, I was mugged. I get that. But I'm just saying in general, I think we're okay. That's all I'm saying. I think we're okay. I think there's going to be evil in the world. I think they could be dramatizing a little more. Like where I live, I think it's fine. Now, why did you leave the South Side? What, did you get mugged or was there, I mean, not no, mugged. I mean, did you have fear of it?
The violence was increasing. Where? Yeah.
Where? Did you see it? It was on the news.
It was on the news all
the
time.
There you go. Well, that's my point. It's on the news.
Yeah, but Jim, the violence is always on the news.
On another street.
That's part of what makes news.
On another street near the bars. So, yeah, I think it's more riffraff.
Like 5 blocks away, though. 4 or 5 blocks away. That's a little too close for comfort.
So yeah, you were there how long, Sheila?
Just 9 months.
And
I loved living down there. Yeah.
And now you live in a more suburban environment?
I do, and not that things can't happen there. And I do keep my doors locked, but I feel a little bit safer.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe that's just my
instinct. No, it's good. It's to each their own. No, it's not. It's good instinct. It's your instinct. Your instinct works for you. Mine works for me. Mm-hmm.
Do you remember that old book about the country mouse and the city mouse?
Mm-hmm.
No.
Where you grow up is where you're comfortable overall.
That's exactly right.
And
I'm more comfortable
with it. When one would cross over to the other, now the city mouse goes to the farm country, and there's things there that they never even considered, like coyotes.
Insects, coyotes, snakes. I see a snake, I'm freaking out. I see fresh air in a tree, I'm really shaking. Look, I'm a guy who grew up, I'm not kidding. To me, the country was when I visited Aunt Dee in Brookline, because there were trees. That was like the country, man.
And you're
I'm in the woods out there. I'm like survival.
You're only half kidding.
No, I'm really serious. I was no,
because he grew up in an alley, near the Heinz History Center. Back when, well, the Strip District is kind of booming right now
with all the
infrastructure development and everything else. But back then, it was more gritty, right?
Well, we weren't paying $3,000 a month for our apartment. Let's put it that way. It was very gritty. It was very gritty. It was a tough area. It was a place we knew each other, though, protected each other, kind of vibe. Like I said, I grew up amongst it, but it's fun. The funny thing is when I would go to my aunties in Brooklyn and Uncle Glenn's, and they had the backyard with the trees and the woods, and I'd go walking in the woods, man. It was like, I'm serious. I was like some survivalist dude, man. I thought I could have been in like some huge forest. I was in the rainforest of Pittsburgh, man. This was a creek. Some creek probably coming from some manufacturing plant, but I'm thinking it's like some pristine water, you know?
I went to college in Nebraska, and I remember the first spring break I was there. One of my sorority sisters took me home to her farm.
There you go.
And we were getting up at 5 o'clock in the morning, milking cows, riding horses.
I can't see you.
Chickens running around.
Working on a farm is kind of like being in a morning show host.
Who are you milking, Larry?
You're really tired? You're really tired all day?
It's like that Meet the Parents.
Do you ever see Paul Harvey's, if out there, if you listen, Paul Harvey, type in on YouTube, The Farmer. It makes you really proud about our country and the way farmers do work, man. It is a thankless job they love.
Comment.
Yeah, The Farmer is a great man. Here's The Farmer who gets up and milks the cow at 5 a.m. Good day.
Well, let me ask you about Thanksgiving traditions growing up. Sheila.
Yeah, here's what I remember about Thanksgiving, okay? Mm-hmm. All day long, the men, I had my father and three brothers, were sitting in front of the TV watching football.
Here it comes, Jim.
And the women, what were we doing? Well, I didn't do too much cooking because I was a kid. But we did the setting of the table, the polishing of the silver. And then when Thanksgiving meal was all over, the guys would go back to their football games, and I and my female companion,
right,
whose parents we always had Thanksgiving with, would be in the kitchen all night long cleaning. Okay,
what?
That's what I remember about Thanksgiving.
Wow.
Do I have a chip on my shoulder? Yeah,
it's a little rough there.
Maybe just a little.
A little bit rough.
Just a little.
Attitude changed immediately, Jim.
Oh, my God.
You guys look guilty, though.
I don't
know what you're talking about.
I know exactly what you're talking about. Yeah, I grew up, my grandmother would always have a big Thanksgiving growing up, and it was cool because all the relatives would be there. It'd be big. I remember these big tables in a strip district. There's the Mulberry Way, row house next to the church. And the big thing for me was, I was probably about, I don't know, 12 years old, 13, my grandmother drank Manischewitz wine. I thought it was like, I drank a sip of, she gave me like a little sip of a little thing in a glass every Thanksgiving, man. And I was like, this is awesome, this wine. I couldn't wait for my wine every year. I was like a sommelier of Manischewitz. But it was, the little things like that and just certain things, that certain foods, man. Like my favorite food, my grandmother would make my mom makes too, are these candied sweet potatoes who just taste, they taste like candy. There's nothing healthy about them. That's like my favorite thing. The turkey's great, but it's the surrounding things that I think we crave as far as the odd, like I crave
cranberry
that.
Sauce.
I crave that once a year, that candied yam thing. I'm sure you got to have one thing that you go, I got to have that.
And what I is do. It? Stuffing, I like maybe? The jellied cranberry that comes out of the can, you slice
old
it,
school.
Slides all over the plate.
A little tart, you like kind
of?
The only thing that we had for Thanksgiving that we didn't have any other time of the year was pumpkin pie with Cool Whip.
You know, it's true. Pie. I don't really remember myself very often. Maybe if I'm in a diner or something on the road to stand up, get a pumpkin pie. But other than that,
well,
it's Thanksgiving the only time you get it.
Down in Northside, Winner's Bakery, Ann, and she, that was their contribution when they'd come, was that. So they had the apple and a couple others, but the pumpkin.
I bet it was great.
Fresh pumpkin pie with the whipped cream, you know.
Yes, I mean, Cool Whip, baby.
So
it was
good.
Awesome.
Cool Whip.
And as a kid, you didn't, you know.
It's not
I'm
you
not
get
saying
that
we
time.
Were poor.
No, but still.
We
know.
Weren't poor, poor, but we didn't have extra stuff, you know. It wasn't like now. Kids, I mean, it's not even close. You didn't think about it then.
No, it was
but
cool.
That was special.
It was cool. It was fun. Yeah, it was real special.
Like, man, I told you guys, with four boys, me and my three brothers, then my sister came later, but we would devastate when my mom would go shopping once a week on a Friday, and she, I can remember like it was yesterday, saying, don't inhale all this stuff, you know, and she'd get the chips with the B&L French onion dip.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
Right.
Which is still.
Still classic.
A treat.
Still works.
When I have that, but. My dad, who worked three nights a week, if he came home and there would be nothing to eat, remember I told you guys, he bought those sickening little cans
right.
of sardines that you had to put
and
the
he
key
liked
in.
It. Yeah. Yes.
When it would snap.
The smell.
Oh,
and he loved it. You know what's funny when you're saying that? My favorite holiday movie, and the reason I think it is because the majority of the people, I think, live like... We did. I'm not, right. not poor, really, but just poor enough or whatever. Just, or not handed to us or whatever it is, the word would be, but A Christmas Story. Just hits home, I think, with a lot of people.
It's my
and I think,
favorite,
and
too.
I think that's why we all relate to because it, isn't that, that's what it is.
Yeah.
It's a Christmas
yeah.
story, man. You know, like my grandfather and so would have like a language of his own that's swearing. I didn't even understand the words. He made them up. Just like, you know.
Well, you know, that house, which is in Cleveland that they shot the film in.
Yeah, yeah.
Is up for sale now
yeah. again.
Yeah,
and
it
they
is.
Built
oh,
they built
it, guys.
A little museum next to it, and I guess that's part of it. But it's an Airbnb too right now.
Oh, is it?
I can't believe they're selling it.
And the guy that was the kid, I can't remember his name.
Peter Billingsley.
Ralphie.
I don't know why I know that. I think it's is that his name? Peter Billingsley or something?
Yeah, that sounds right.
Is that his
you
name?
Know what, that might be it.
Something like that. Ralphie
or
was
the
brother. Was
oh,
Ralphie.
Ralphie was the brother. Brother's okay.
Ralphie. Can't remember the kid's name now.
He is. Good friends
okay.
with Vince Vaughn, the comedian.
Money, baby,
when
money.
When Vince was in his first movie, he was in a movie, you know, because after that, he got a shot at some movies to be an actor.
Right, right.
And his career kind of fizzled after that. But now there's this big retro, and you're going to be seeing this guy. I can't remember
good.
His name.
I think it. Let's
Let
look
see.
It up. I think it's Peter Billings.
Right.
Vince, I just watched
hey,
Swing.
Siri, who played the kid in A Christmas Story? She's thinking
about it. Siri's quiet.
Yeah.
She's not talking to you right now. Siri's mad at you. My Siri's mad at me, too.
You know what? She has an attitude sometimes, doesn't she?
Peter Billingsley is right.
Thank you.
He was 9 years old. Ralphie.
Oh, he was Ralphie.
He was Ralphie?
So who was his son?
Who was the son? Or, I mean, the brother. Yeah, who was the brother? We'll have to look that one up.
How about you guys?
See, I don't have...
Oh,
I knew
that movie.
I knew
on
that.
It's on the loop, you know, 24 hours a day at Christmas time.
I can't wait.
We turn it on in the morning and it just
plays all day. I have a mini Ralphie doll that somebody gave. I got it as one of those gag gifts. You know, you go to a Christmas party and you exchange gag gifts.
Somebody give you a Ralphie.
Yeah, but I loved it.
And you kept it. And look what's behind your shoulder, Larry.
There's the lake, the lamp. Yes.
What are the odds? In this studio, folks, is the leg lamp.
The glow of, I remember the line, Gene Shepherd said, the glow of sex in a window.
A miniature leg lamp.
Now, there is, for some reason, you guys would have to find it out there somewhere. But there is a short that what
it does work.
The, the glow
up.
The glow of sex in the window. But there is a movie that was I saw it only one time. It was on PBS years ago, and it is Gene Shepherd, the same one guy who did the narration all for this all is right with that warm voice and wrote the best Thanksgiving ever. And he did a Thanksgiving movie that was a lot like A Christmas Story. I remember it just being fantastic. I'm amazed it's not shown or I haven't seen it since. I saw it like one time as a kid. I just remember it being just unbelievably fun. I'm old enough that I saw A Christmas Story in a movie theater in Bloomfield, believe it or not. That's how old I came when it first came out.
I don't think anybody actually saw it when it first came out.
There was no one but me and Robert Ludensky and a couple of people that saw it in the Kenny. We're in the Bloomfield movie theater. I lived on Taylor Street in Bloomfield at the time, and there's only like a handful of people in the whole theater, and I go, that is the greatest movie I've ever seen Christmas-wise. I go, why isn't it bigger? I couldn't believe it. I loved it. And then all of a sudden,
wait a minute.
Caught on.
You lived in a strip in an alley.
Yeah.
You've lived on the north side at the old schoolhouse across from Allegheny General.
Yeah, and lived in Bloomfield.
You lived in Bloomfield.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. You lived in Greentree.
Yep.
Scott Township.
Mm-hmm.
You live in the south side.
Yep. Yeah.
You're like he's like a nomad.
I was a nomad. It's funny. When I started on radio, coming off stand-up, the old Yinzer thing wasn't looked at as, it was looked at as down. People were down. And I started thinking, why? It's kind of cool, man. It's like, it's who I am. Now, I had lived on the north. At that point, I had lived on north side. I've lived in Bloomfield at that point. I lived in the Strip District. I knew friends in Hazelwood. I knew friends. So I was able to do the character Stanley Pikachowski, but real. Like, I can go deep into the like, if you lived in that neighborhood, I made a reference. They're like, wait a second. That can't be. That's not just some, he's there. How do you know that? Or that's Pittsburgh. So that's what struck a little chord that gave me I knew that was going to give me, because I knew those neighborhoods. I lived in those neighborhoods. I was friends with those people. They're my family. And so that's what kind of started that character, Stanley P. So it's kind of cool.
You brought those characters to life, and they resonated with people because
it was
everybody
really fun.
Could relate to having a friend who was, or they were, Stanley P. Give us a little Stanley P.
Stanley P., he lives on Southside. He went to college at community college. He's an intellect. He went to community. He spent 7 years there. It was year four. They broke the news to me that it was a 2-year college. Now, ain't my fault. I stayed 7 years. I got graduated. Had all my credits. But I was going to go down Pitt. But I got a job over Heinz. Started as a pickler. Ended up head pickler. Got a little crazy. Went a little, material. Bought a pea green Vega. Got a little nuts, you know what I mean? Living large. Yeah, had a vacation home up in Latrobe. I was at Gorn. I mean, I'm living large. And then, boom, stock market crash. All my stocks went down. I put everything in Zayers stock. And I just got crushed on that. And I still love Zayers till this day. Never saw it coming.
That's interesting.
Loved it. But anyway.
Knowing you, I didn't know you then, but I really got to know you after. And the genesis of your characters, like the whole Teamsters Today thing, resonated. You told us about
my
where
grandpa.
You got. Yeah.
Grandpa was the head of local 270, the
was it 279?
249.
I'm sorry, I'm getting wrong. So because that was the I made the
I only
I made the fake one.
I had an uncle in 249. 249.
He was the you know the leader of.
I have a brother in 249 now.
So I was there when you know he'd have people over the kitchen from you know things today sitting there, you know talking about what this ain't right. This ain't right, Ski, as my grandpa's nickname. We got to fix this, Ski. So I just listened to them, and that's where the character of Vinny Guzzo came from. You know, 289. I made up some number. I don't know, whatever Teamster union I was, you know. And, you know, Teamster, it was a show. Teamster Today, the show that asked the question, you got a problem with that?
So it was, I love that.
So it became.
When did you first start making up characters?
When
were you just a kid?
Yeah. When I was a kid, I'd make them up. No, when I was on stand up full time, I was on 5-6 shows a week. Little did I know, I was training for radio. I didn't know. But, either that or a development deal in L.A. Either one was going to go somewhere. But I started to work on the characters on the road, and I didn't know what I was going to do with them because I didn't know how to put them in a stand-up yet. I really didn't learn how to storytell yet. I was mainly doing impressions to make a living. I was good at it, and it was, you know, good sometimes could be the enemy of great. It's holding me back a little from trying, from breaking new ground.
Wow. Where did you get that line?
Uncle Dirty. This guy, I was a
good
kid.
Good can be the enemy of great.
Could I have
that? Okay, we'll write that down.
Well, here's what happened. At the time, the Tropicana was a big deal. If you got the Trop, you got 6-7 weeks of work a year. You got headliner money. You only had to do 20 minutes. They had three guys. I was working at Dangerville. So three comedians from New York. They can get real cheap. They put us up in a beautiful condo. Get a couple grand for a week. You did 20 minutes a night. Here's the thing, though. You work Monday through Sunday. Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. I don't know this. At the time, I'm 25, right? 24, 25. I don't know this, but and I'm just starting to headline. And it's like boxing. The image of if you have bad shows, it gets out. You can drop back the middle real quick. You bad shows here, you drop the MC. You could drop out real quick, the word of mouth. But anyway, this was a high-profile gig in a sense that everyone will know about it, New York and whatever. And how it works in that world is, then anyway, if you had one bad show, you got a pass. If you got two, you were replaced. If you were replaced, you're going to be replacing all your other gigs. They're going to find out about it. People are going to say, yeah, you hear about Jim Cranio. So anyway, I go into Monday, and they give tickets to all senior citizens, and I'm 24, 25. They bus them in from Philly, and they're literally 80 years old. They're all white. I am, at the time, doing impressions of for audiences in a comedy club. The comedy club demo is 21 to 34 at the time. Some 25 to 54. It's like almost radio. A younger demo, not in the 60, 80, to 80 range or 90. So each guy's to do 20 minutes. Now, I'm on the bill with this guy, Jack Cohen, who ended up being a big producer somewhere. You can see his name sometime. Uncle Dirty, this big guy with a hat. He said he wrote for Richard Pryor and George Carlin. He opened for the Grateful Dead for many years. And he told me this, and about 2 years later, I saw Pryor on The Tonight Show talking about Uncle Dirty. And I go, oh my God, it's right. So anyway, I do my first show, and I bomb, which means I'm one show away from done. Done. My career. I'd have to start over again after working my way to headline. I'm sitting outside the show after bombing. My head is down. Uncle Dirty sits down, lights up a joint. That was before it was illegal, but he didn't care. He had a little beanie on, picture, big guy, looked kind of like Santa Claus, okay? Really, beard, white hair, no hair on top, white, kind of like a heavy Gallagher or something. But anyway, he looks at me and goes, tough show, huh? I go, yeah, I guess you know you're going home tomorrow. I said, yep. He said, yeah, if you bomb. He says, I'll tell you what, kid. He said, I saw you. He said, now, he's the guy who later in that week said, he gave me my advice was, you're good, but good is the enemy of great. Don't forget that. He said, I need you to break out and do the. I did a couple stories here and there, but off the stage, he's crying. He goes, you're a storyteller. You got to get that on stage. I know you're making a lot of money. He said, so you're not going to do it. He said, good is the enemy of great. I never forgot that until I finally did do it.
Wow.
You got to take that risk from good. If it all falling apart, to be great, to do something great. But anyway, get back to the thing where I bombed. He looked at me. He said, why is this guy? He goes, tell you what, you have nothing to lose. I said, yeah. He goes, do as I say tomorrow. I go, what? He goes, the first 2 minutes of your show, the first 2 minutes, you are not allowed to do your material. You're not allowed to do impressions. You're not allowed to do anything, funny lines that you had before. You're not to do any material at all. You just have to walk up on stage. The first 2 minutes. Now, 2 minutes is a long time. in a weird way on stage. So I said, that's crazy. He goes, well, you're going to go home anyway, because that audience is going to know you. So I said, okay, I'll do it. So I'm can't sleep at night next time, sold out show. Everyone looked at it's white hair everywhere. So I'm in walkers, the whole thing. So I go up and Uncle Dirty looks at me before I go and he goes, 2 minutes. I said, okay. I walk out. I don't know what to say because I'm going to have to wait 2 minutes. I'm standing. Now, here's what Uncle Dirty, he bet on me. He bet on me because he heard this. He felt that was funny. Now he just bet on me. And I go, I look at this lady. And she had a bingo bag because they played bingo in a casino or something. I go, is that a bingo bag? She goes, yeah. I go, and I just talk. I go, I take my grandmother to bingo every Wednesday in Pittsburgh. Every Wednesday, her and I pick her up. And just the fact that I just was talking, I didn't realize, but I take my grandmother to bingo. Their hearts. Oh, my God. I love him.
This boy. Yes. We love him.
And then I start talking about my grandmother. And saying some things, a couple things about her and a couple jokes, you know, I'll see whatever. Next thing you know, I am doing 20 minutes of things they don't even understand. Same act as night before, got a standing ovation.
Wow.
Because, and I got off stage and he goes, he says, always remember that the first 2 minutes make them like you. I said, okay. I always remember that. Make them like
wow.
you. And then, like I said, later in that week, he said, my act is like a technician. After Thursday, I didn't have to do the 2 minute thing. I did it the next day, bingo. I had a little bit of routine, but then I went back to my act because it was back to normal, a younger audience for me. But he did at the end of that run say, you're really good. He goes, but good is the enemy of great. Don't forget that. And as I went on, I realized he's absolutely right in the sense that.
And Dirty told you this.
Uncle Dirty. And it took me years to figure out to take the risk. To say, you know what, I got to push the impressions back. Still do them. It's a gift I have to do it. God gave me. But I have to get these stories out. And it's hard. And I didn't do as well. But then it turned. And so all of a sudden it became a signature. And it opened up a whole ocean of material. He was absolutely right.
Wow.
So he was one of the wisest people ever for me. We run into people like that, all of us in life. We have to think about that person. But there was a guy named Uncle Dirty. It was important in my career.
Why was he called Uncle Dirty?
I was just like his thing. He was dirty. He told dirty jokes. Yeah. Like kind of dirty.
You know Richard Pryor, and yeah. He's writing for him.
He wrote for Carlin, George Carlin also.
And back when those guys were, outliers. They were edgy.
Class clown, man. Yeah.
Did you ever any stand-up? Sheila.
You're looking at me. Me stand up?
Because you got this.
You're talented.
Really great sense of humor. You're intelligent.
I have a great sense of humor, but you know what? I'm terrible at joke telling, though.
That's just it. You might be a storyteller. It's just one of the things where I think certain people, like you guys could, anybody could perform like you guys can do it. Because one, it takes being comfortable. The audience, a guy named Kip Adada is another comedian. He did many Tonight Shows, and I learned a lot from this guy.
I remember that name.
He was brilliant, one of my favorite comedians of all time. But and he was just, I was 20-some years old. He's like 50, but he just knew the game. And he basically said the same thing as Dirty, which was, got to try to make it. This was even before Dirty. He kind of mentioned it. It didn't resonate until, the Tropicana thing. But it was just the way he said, if you're comfortable on stage, Jim, the audience is empathizing with you. When Elvis is on stage, I'm Elvis. If Elvis is comfortable, I'm comfortable. If Elvis sings great, I sing great. If he doesn't, I kind of disassociate. If you see an act on stage not do well, that's not in your mind. Subliminally, skits, you're going to go, I wouldn't. Like when they see a guy get up cool, he's laid back, I'm riffing, I'm doing lines, I'm, just everything's going great. Deep down, you're thinking, that's the way I would do it. I'm comfortable. I'm connecting with this person.
You know, there's only one thing an audience will
break.
Not forgive you? Being boring.
Yes. And actually being nervous,
you
too.
You can get away with almost anything, but if you bore them, they want nothing to do with
you. Once you disassociate the audience with nervousness and boredom and whatever, you're done.
Yeah.
So being calm and being a performer, my point is, you guys would have the... You are developing stand-up. The same reason I'm saying, because you're comfortable and you're able to connect.
Well,
so once you connect...
You make me comfortable. So when I introduce you when you're doing a stand-up performance, it's so natural for me to do that because of the relationship I have with you. But then I found I'm not what I would consider a comedian. I'm more of a humorist.
Right. Storyteller.
Yeah.
It was just a comedian.
And then your stories can't be too long because right. people's attention span.
Start learning how to do it.
Have, yeah. So you taught me, you know, setting things up. Yeah. Just what you did at Steamworks at our last show. Mm. We did Beth Klausen's Porch Concert.
Mm.
You got up before you sang, and you got everybody on your side before they heard a note. And I realize now that that's part of your
Uncle Dirty
mindset. Yeah.
Make them like
A couple of little jokes just to, you talked about their little Christmas tree, and let's not forget why we're here tonight to raise money to get a bigger Christmas tree. And, you know, it was like people looked at the tree and you disarmed everybody.
Yeah.
So then when you sang, in your case, that's breaking new ground.
Yeah, I'm a little nervous. So I got to make myself
because
not nervous.
Out of your comfort zone. Yeah. But I appreciate that you're pushing yourself to do that because good
is the enemy of great. And if you look at every great performer out there, that's probably what they follow, right?
Right.
They're not good, they're great. So they had to be, they had to break that mold of good to get to great. And we all do.
Larry, you are, surprisingly, you come off as funny. I didn't realize you were as much of a comedian as you actually are.
It's funny. I don't think of myself as funny, but I'm an observationalist. And working with Jimmy, I felt, again, the comfort to introduce him. So I could tell a couple of stories, and then it's integrated with stuff that maybe we did in our travels or people we've encountered. And it's really comfortable. And then I realize I'm not afraid anymore.
But that's just it. It's a transition of, like, you just had a different background than me. Your background was through radio, okay? You are performing in front of a lot of people. You know, you guys know, it is like diamond cutting to do what you would do, because in a sense, you one wrong word, you're done. Mm-hmm. One wrong phrase, you're done. So that's how it's like diamond cutting.
True.
It seems like breathing, but it is. It's actually something God gives us, certain talents, and God gave you the talent to do that. Now, I had a road where I was doing 5 to 6 shows live in the club, because it's a comedy club boom, for 6 years.
Wow.
Before going on. So I was doing, that's a heck of a minor leagues
so
workout.
So when you went on radio, you weren't.
That was a set of next to combat comedy. And comedy.
Yeah, that's why you were successful.
I was getting 4 laughs a minute.
You were just rolling, and on the radio, people weren't used to having a comedian, and you knew how to work the medium.
I was lucky, because at that time, it was album-oriented rock formats, and they were rated 17th in the market. Jimmy and Steve, the morning show, was not there. They had lost them.
Right, they went to Lauderdale.
And you got them all the way up to number one.
Oh, in a year. This is a rebuild. And I didn't know I was going to move to L.A., and ended up staying, obviously. But when I got on there, there was freedom and no one listening. So they asked me to keep coming back. I went on as a guest. I was doing a club called Graffiti when I was in. Did impressions. They asked me to come back. I kept coming back and kept doing the impressions. It was comfortable. It was like a sedative next to stand-up. On stand-up, you're getting 3 to 4 laughs a minute for an hour. In radio, you're kind of talking, using that instinct. But it was like you said, Lair, it was new, because at the time, I didn't realize, to looking back, this is 1987, 88, the DJs were like Rick Dees. They were wacky, corny DJs, was the comedian.
Just the morning zoos.
Howard Stern was only in New York City. He wasn't syndicated yet. Mm-hmm. So I didn't even know about him, but I later found out that's what he was doing, conversational, personal thing. You know, Rick Dees and those guys, they were brilliant, brilliant broadcasters, man. And he knew how to convey things. Those guys were sharp, but you didn't know who they were. They had great voices. They knew how to carry it. They were likable, but they weren't opening up who they were. And so I was fortunate to not know what I was doing, because when they first started, I was making mistakes. And they were trying to correct those. And finally, they were getting reviews that people liked me, and they didn't. There was a quandary. Do we keep this guy? Because he's, you know, people like him, but he's not doing a regular format of a radio. And I learned quickly to myself, I was the king of imperfection. And people like imperfection, because we're all imperfect. We're all imperfect. But anyway, that style.
Yeah, you always were, to me, not knowing you, like the quintessential Pittsburgh guy.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
And that's who I am as part of
it. Ask anyone about Jim Crenn, and they'll tell you that. You know, what's interesting is the two of you were competitors, direct competitors with each other.
And yet
you are the best of friends now.
You know,
it's
I learned
a terrific story.
I learned from great people, from Dennis Miller comedically to Jerry Seinfeld, Jay Leno. I had heavy conversations with all these guys. And the one common thread with the greats, and I always look for common thread. The common thread was, Jimmy, you are not in competition with anyone. You're in competition with yourself. That is it. Let's let the chips fall where they may. Mm. People are jealous of you, angry at you. We live in your world. You are in competition to do your best. And you should help others to do their best.
And therein lies why we're friends.
Yeah.
He helps others do their best. And he has no ego in that world. And that's how we became friends.
I love working with Larry.
I'm getting misty now. Yeah.
Well, I love working with Larry because I love working with talented people. And you too, Sheila.
Next time we're going to wrangle my yin and yang radio partner, Marty Griffin, for our 50th
episode.
Get ready.
I can't wait for
that
show.
I better get a seatbelt.
Larry Richard Unfiltered with Jim Krenn, Sheila Hyland, episode 49 is a wrap. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Larry.
Hey, it's Jen Hatmaker. Here's what I've learned in midlife. Joy isn't the reward you earn after all the work is done. Joy is the work. That's what this new series on For the Love is all about. The sacred, yes. It's choosing delight, rest, and pleasure on purpose. Because saying yes to yourself, that's the thing that finally lets you fill your table with everybody else. Come find your sacred yes with me. Follow and listen to For the Love wherever you get your podcasts.